So today I continue my presentation of non-abelian gauge theories by discussing or starting to discuss the process of quantization. This is of course the main stuff to be treated and the difficult part or the important part. So remember, we started from an extending the standard Maxwell gauge theory, which has in fact a U1 gauge invariance, to an invariance with a gauge group, which is not gauge group of symmetry, which is associated to the symmetry of the matter to which this gauge theory will be coupled, which is non-abelian. So in practice, I consider the simple case of non-abelian group theory, non-abelian group, which is the SU2 group. So in this theory, instead of having one electromagnetic field, we have three, because A equal 1, 2, 3, which are associated to the generator of SU2 group transformation, and SU2 has three generators. And therefore, you can regroup, in fact, those gauge theory into an AMU of X, which is the sum over A of A mu A TA, where the TA are the generator. So that's a compact notation, which is convenient. And for SU2, or in general, for a general group, you have the number of generator, which is the dimension of the Lie group. And for SU2, the generator are, if I'm not remember, 1/2 of the Pauli matrices. Okay, remember that the Pauli matrices are 2 by 2 traceless symmetric or Hermitian matrices. So in fact, this field is a 2 by 2 traceless Hermitian matrices. Okay. These are a field with value in the Lie algebra. So this is a field in value. So it belongs to the Lie algebra. Algebra. Little SU2 of SU2. Okay. And we defined, which is an actual concept, which is the extension of the covariant derivative in electromagnetism, is a covariant derivative, so d mu, which is a covariant derivative operator. And this covariant derivative, the important point is that acting, for instance, on a field which belongs to mu, to the Lie algebra, it's the ordinary derivative plus the commutator. So the covariant derivative, rather, let's say this way, if we consider a field phi of x which belongs to the fundamental representation, that's f is for fundamental, namely it's two field phi high. So it's phi 1, phi 2 for SU2. So it belongs to the fundamental representation. So you have two fields with two different charges, a complex field, x of x. So in general, they are going to be denoted as phi I of x. The covariant derivative acts on a field in the fundamental representation as the ordinary derivative and the plus or minus, I think it's minus, but I always forgot. It's plus, I'm sorry. It's plus I mu. No, it's minus. Da, da, Ta-ta-ta-ta. I always forgot my notation. It's minus mu phi I f. So this is similar to, well, let me check. Ta-ta-ta. I have mixed my page already. I'm lacking a stapler. No. So it's okay, why for a field in the fundamental representation, d mu phi, for a field in the adjoint representation, d mu phi is the ordinary derivative, d mu phi a, minus I, so there's a minus I, the commutator of a mu is phi a. So this is a 2x2 matrix. Well, in the adjoint, this is a 2x2 matrix. This is a 2x2 matrix. So you can define the commutator, and minus I is a 2x2 matrix with the right symmetry property. So this is somehow a simple extension of field in the adjoint representation, except that here you have a vector and here a matrix. So the covariant derivative mixes the component of the field, as it should. We have a non-abelian, and here it's a commutator. So this is new because for electromagnetism, where the adjoint representation is trivial, this term is not present. Okay, so now, and from that we define an action, S of A, which is the generalization of the action is defined out of the, so it was if I'm minus 1 over 2g squared integral over d4x of the trace of the tensor, the f mu nu with f mu nu is a commutator of d mu d nu. In fact, it involves the derivatives of the field and the commutator of the field. So now, there are new terms compared to the electromagnetism due to the fact that we have the commutator of the field, which of the gauge field, which are non-zero. Okay, and finally, we need, of course, to know that what is a gauge transformation. So what is a gauge transformation? I've not written that. Well, the gauge transformation on the matter field are usual, but what's important is what is the gauge transformation on a mu. The gauge transformation is generated by some alpha of x gauge generator, which is now an element of the Lie algebra. So it has three components. So it can be written as alpha A of X TA. So there are three degrees of freedom for the gauge generator, so it's a 2x2 matrix. And D mu, a gauge transformation on the gauge field, transform A mu into A mu plus the covariant derivative of alpha. Namely, it's A mu plus d mu alpha minus I, the commutator of a mu with alpha. Remember, those are field dependent on x. So this is the derivative of alpha, which this is a 2x2 matrix, 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 this is a 2x2 matrix. So to think of this in terms of matrices, and if you want to write this in terms of the component a mu and the component alpha mu, well, you have to compute, and this involves the fundamental, the structure constant of the algebra. Okay, so this is the non-abelian generalization of the ordinary gauge transformation for Maxwell. You see that the fact that the symmetry is non-abelian requires that you have this commutator term, which is new. Okay, so this is new. And it turns out that under a gauge transformation, the action is invariant. So we have constructed the classical theory, which is gauge invariant. Okay, and in fact, this is an infinitesimal gauge transformation. But this is just the fact that if you integrate, that's because you consider a gauge transformation by, in fact, if you consider a not a global, but a non-infinitesimal, the general gauge transformation. It is generated by some function g of x, which is a function from space-time, let's see, M3 or R4 if we are in this is Minkowski space or Euclidean space if we are in the Euclidean or in the Minkowski metric, onto the group itself. So at each point of the space, you associate a gauge transformation. And therefore, and in this quantity, a general macroscopic gauge transformation, in fact, for AMU transform AMU of X. Let's write it into G times AMU plus I, the ordinary derivative of G minus 1. So this is a 2x2 matrix. You take its derivative. This is a 2x2 matrix. This is a 2x2 matrix. You see? And you can check that if you consider an infinitesimal gauge transformation where G of X is 1 plus I alpha of X and keep the term of order 1 in alpha, you get this out of this. So this is a gauge transformation that I'm going to write AMU G. I start AG, AMU and I deform it by a general gauge transformation G. And that's the infinitesimal form of this. Okay, so that's the idea. So this was my first transplant. And now, how do we perform quantization? Well, so there are different ways to quantize gauge theories. There is canonical quantization that you have seen in QFT1 and in quantum theory, which is possible for non-Abelian gauge theories, but it's more difficult than Maxwell because you see, because of this non-linear term, gauge theories are intrinsically interacting theory, and you have no way, or you can consider a limit when the coupling is very small, but there are lots of constraints. So you are not free, like in quantum electrodynamics, to tune the charge of the electron. Okay, so another procedure is, of course, functional integration or path integral. And if we trust the law of integration by functional integral, if we trust Richard Feynman and all the physicists after that had developed the formalism, it should work. So we'd like to define some partition function. Let me write a classical term Z as a functional integral over all gauge field configuration, d mu a, of exponential of, well, let me 1 over h bar, if you want, the action. You want to define something like that, where s, the action, I stayed in the Minkowski framework. In the, I'm sorry, in the Euclidean framework, for simplicity, to not keep track of the I factor, but that's not important. It's more laziness than. Okay, so in principle, this should. If we define this functional integral, we can define expectation value of observable, so including some operators, and compute in this way vacuum expectation value of time ordered products of operator and recover the physical matrix element of operator of the series. Okay, so in principle, this would work, but in the case of gauge theory, there are technical difficulties, in particular to derive perturbation theory, which in fact are present in Maxwell theory, and is due to gauge invariance. So that's a problem which is already present in Maxwell and which generalized to non-abelian gauge theories. But that's the same problem. Simply the solution is more complicated. It's the fact that the action is the same. If we perform a into A of G, if I remove the A mu, if we make a gauge transformation, S of A, G is equal to S of A. This means that you have flat direction. This implies there are what are called flat directions. So a very large set of transformation on the field which do not change the physics. Those are, of course, the gauge transformation. Gauge transformation so in particular, this implies that if you consider a classical solution which minimizes the action, for instance, A equals zero, which is a perturbative vacuum. If you have A equals zero, you have no electric field, you have no magnetic field. If you are, for instance, A equals zero, and you perform a gauge transformation, well, you get is this is zero. But you get G minus I d mu of G, so you get, well, you can see the same thing infinitesimally, you get a d mu of alpha, which is non-zero, this one. So you get AG, which is G minus G d mu of G minus 1, which is non-trivial. It's a pure gauge. But it's a different gauge field. So this is just a standard gauge invariant. This is a pure gauge, for instance. Okay. Now think about what this means in the space of gauge configuration. So now I'm going to draw a picture which is very, very schematic. But, and now, try to not get rid of. Okay. Yes. So let me figure what's going on in the big space of gauge field configuration. Of course, it's going to be an infinite dimensional space, but that's the space on which we are going to integrate. So let me call it A. So A is a space of old. It's the space of old A. So I have a very big space. So let me draw it a bit like that. Of course, I'm restricting an infinite dimensional space into a two-dimensional space, but that's better. Yes?
What do you mean exactly by flat direction?
Flat direction means that the action is the same. So if here, you know, if they actually think about in terms of having some kind of potential, if you have some potential in the field configuration, you have direction of space where the potential stays the same. If this is a potential, and the field space. If you look for, if you have a minimum of the action, along the bottom of the valley, you still have other minima. That's terminology, flat direction. It's, okay, so let's go back. We have this big space of all configuration, and to each field, to each A, so A is a point in A. So let's consider a given A. For instance, A equals zero, but any A. But now, let's consider the space of gauge transformations. So that's the space that I'm going to call, well, calligraphic G in my notes, which is a set of all possible function G. So A is means the data of some all O mu A of X. Okay. While G is the data of some element G of X, which belong to SU2. So for each X, I have an element of SU2. I assume it's a smooth. Okay, so you have a special gauge transformation, and this is a group. You see, because the gauge transformation is just a gauge transformation which is different in any way. So in some sense, this gauge group is just an infinite product for all x in space-time of G, where G, you have a gauge, you have your space-time, M, and to each point of x, you associate an element G of x of the group. A mathematician would say, I have a fiber bundle of the group above space-time. Okay. So this is a group. An infinite dimensional Lie group. But it's just a direct product of finite dimensional group. So that's a space, or rather, it's a space which is a group of all gauge transformation. So this group, calligraphic G, acts on the space calligraphic A of the gauge field configuration. Because for any element of the group, G, I can perform a gauge transformation, A to AG, without changing the physics. But I change the gauge field configuration. And since J is a product of Lie group which are continuous, in fact, you can define what is called the orbit of A. So to each A, I can associate the sets of all the gauge field configuration obtained from A by applying some gauge transformation G here, here G prime, here G double prime, etc. You see. And since the gauge is transformation, those orbits are also are some continuous subspace. They are a manifold of A. Okay. So now, well, the sets, all the elements in the orbit of some given A are the gauge configuration, which are gauge equivalent to the original A. So let's call it A0. Okay. And now, of course, you have other field configurations which are not, if they are not gauge equivalent, it means that the orbit is different. So here I have some A0, I have some A1. Well, 0 is a bit, let's call it A0, A1. If A1 is not gauge equivalent to I0, it means that the orbit of A. So this is the orbit of A1. So a mathematician will state, just in a slightly more elaborate language, that two configurations are not gauge equivalent if their orbits are different. Okay. And if I take a third one, A2, have a different orbit, etc. So you see. So and you know, all the gauge field configuration in the same orbit gave the same physics. So the space, in fact, of physical configuration in fact, it's the quotient of A under the action of G. It's a quotient space. It's a set of orbits. Because, as we know, you know, gauge invariance means that describing the physics of a gauge field by a gauge potential A is very convenient for many reasons, in particular because here the Lorentz covariance of the invariance of the series manifest, but it encodes more information. So some of the degrees of freedom are just spurious, and all the degrees of freedom which are spurious are those encoded in gauge transformation. So gauge transformation are spurious, they are not physical. They are there in order to describe the conveniently the physics. Okay. So the set space of physical configuration is a set of orbits, not the set of all A. So in fact, in this functional integral, we should distinguish the A which are gauge equivalent from the one which are not gauge equivalent. Well, we know how to do that. In fact, you have seen that when quantizing Maxwell's theory. How do we do the calculation in space of physical configuration? Well, solution is that we choose a gauge fixing condition. So gauge fixing condition means, in fact, choosing, and here I'd like to have a somehow red, but it seems that the red chokes are very difficult. Oh, there was a yellow, that's one, orange. Red chokes seems to be very different to find at the Perimeter Institute. Maybe they are just taken to draw Canadian flags. Okay, so anyway, so what is a gauge fixing condition? It means choosing on each orbit, I don't know if so, choosing on each orbit a particular A, and only one for each orbit, and dealing only with the A that satisfies it. So, okay. So A gauge fixing condition means fixing a condition on A. And for instance, the most well known is d mu a mu is zero. But because it's Lorentz invariant, but you have others. And so this is called the Lorentz gauge, I think, Lorentz-Landau or Landau gauge. But basically, this means that you fix a condition on A, which define your, you enforce this on A, and you obtain such what we are going to call a gauge slice S. So this gauge S, a calligraphic S here, you know, is a slice orthogonal to the orbits. Gauge slice S, which is orthogonal to the orbits. Okay. And you integrate of that. And you have to integrate, you want to integrate only on this gauge slice. And in this way, you have eliminated the fact that you are integrating over flat direction, because instead of integrating in direction, you choose a way to go in the valley. Oops. Go up. And you have only one minimum. Here. Okay. So, so integrating over S should be equivalent to integrating over A. Our gauge slice should be equivalent to integrating over this space of physical configuration A quotiented by the action of the gauge group. Yes?
I have a question. So, since the gauge transformation is completely arbitrary, I can choose whatever small a I want, it's not clear to me why don't all of the fields fall in the same orbit.
Pardon? Why?
Since a gauge transformation is arbitrary, I get whatever a lowercase a I want. It's not clear to me why don't all of the fields capital A fall on the same orbit.
You can do that. The problem is that if you do that, in perturbation theory, you have problem. And the problem are related to the fact that the propagator of the gauge field in Maxwell theory has zero modes. The direction where it's infinite, rather. It corresponds to gauge transformation. So the problem is, how do I perform perturbation theory? There are ways of studying this functional integral. For instance, integrating what's called performing lattice gauge theory, where you integrate by a computer over the field configuration, and you can do that. So you integrate many times to its equivalent configuration, but you don't have to deal with gauge invariance, and therefore that's the best way to compute things. You just perform the integration and of a function, and you know that there is a symmetry group of the integration you are not taking into account, but it leads to a better, faster way to make numerical computation. So it's possible. The problem is perturbation theory.
So then how are we picking different orbits? Do we have a freedom to construct any orbits we want?
Pardon?
Then do we have a freedom to construct any orbits we want in the...
No, we have to integrate over all the orbits, you see? We have to integrate over all A. We have to integrate over all the orbits. But we'd like to choose in each orbit only one A satisfying the gauge condition, for instance, the Lorentz gauge. Oh. Okay.
This is clear to me. My problem is, why do we have many orbits, not just one big orbit? Like,
if you had a big orbit, it would mean that all the gauge configuration would be equivalent to A equals zero. You see, so you would have no dynamics. This would be a trivial problem, a trivial system.
Okay.
And you know already on the example of electromagnetism, of Maxwell's theory, that you have a field configuration which are not equivalent under gauge transformation. For instance, the vacuum where E and B, electric and magnetic field, are zero, is not equivalent under gauge transformation to the states where you have an electromagnetic wave which propagates, because it contains some energy, some momentum carried through the electromagnetic wave. So they are not equivalent.
Okay.
Okay, so. Okay, so the idea is now to transform the partition function into something where you integrate over all gauge field configuration, so over A, with the action exponential minus 1 over h bar s of A, but enforce the gauge fixing condition. So for instance, enforce something which I'm going to write very schematically, products over x of a delta function of d mu a mu, for instance, of x. And of course, there is a gauge fixing condition for each a. So it's a product of A and A. A going from 1 to 3, and x, I make a formal product of all points of space time. So if this I'm gauge fixing, I'm enforcing the gauge fixing in the functional integral procedure. Okay, so this means, sometimes if I do that, it means that instead of integrating over the whole space, I integrate over the size. Okay, but you have to be careful, because when you integrate over the slice, you have to define which measure you are integrating over the slice. And if you take this measure, basically you take just the measure induced on the slice by the measure on space of configuration. Okay, well, the measure is naively, well, the measure over A is just, in fact, D of A is just products over X over the ordinary flat measure on over A of D of A mu A of X. And you can check that this measure is gauge invariant. Formally, it's gauge invariant. So you have a measure on the big space calligraphic A. It induced projected measure on A, but you have to be careful, because remember, the gauge field configuration are arbitrary. The gauge fixing procedure, you may choose some arbitrary. So this is an S, but you may imagine that you are taking another gauge configuration, gauge fixing S prime, another slice given by another gauge fixing procedure. And of course, the measure is not the same in general. So you have to compensate this effect. So the question is which measure on the slice? Okay. And the solution of this is given by a something which is called the Fadeyev-Popov determinant. And if I introduce this, I know that I have a correct measure. Okay. So I'm going first to explain what is this Fadeyev-Popov determinant, and then explain shortly why it is this term that has to be enforced. In fact, this Fadeyev-Popov determinant has been also, you know, understood. Well, Fadeyev and Popov were two great Russian theoretical physicists at that time, Soviet Union, from Soviet Union, and Fadeyev is a very famous physicist, which has been very important contribution both in quantization of gauge theories, but also in integrable system, in statistical mechanics, and in quantum field theory. But at the same time, this idea has been also appeared in the works of Feynman himself and Bryce DeWitt, American theoretician known for his work in quantization of gauge theories and of quantum gravity. Okay. So, in order to understand what is the Fadeyev-Popov determinant, you have to consider, in fact, how does the gauge fixing condition changes under a gauge transformation. You see, if you are somewhere on the slice here, and if you perform a gauge transformation by some generator alpha, you are somewhere else. So, you see, if you are on this given slice, by enforcing a gauge, you get out of the slice by performing a gauge transformation. You see. And in fact, you have to see what is the volume of this, you know, change of this thick slice. So, let's do that on the example of the Lorentz gauge. So I'm doing that rather than presenting the way I did that in my notes, because it might be clearer. Oh, I start to mix everything here. Yes. So let me call the gauge fixing condition some functional fa. So gauge fixing, I'm considering a functional f of a at odd point x, which in my case is going to be d mu. I'm sorry, d mu is the upper indices, a mu, so I have an f for each a of x. So that's a set for all a. I denote this a functional of a, some function of a and its derivative. So it's a global. Fixing condition, function. So the gauge fixing condition is, in fact, is just that I want to enforce that f of a is zero to be on the slice. But you can consider this general. Functional. When it's non-zero, it still has a value. It's just the ordinary derivative of A. Okay, and let's see how this, this should be put on the other side. How does this changes if I make a gauge transformation of A? You see, if I change A into A mu plus D mu alpha, if I change A mu of x into A mu of x plus D mu of alpha of x. But d mu of alpha of x, remember, depend on alpha of x. Of course, my gauge fixing condition, d mu mu of x, changes into d mu mu of x plus the ordinary derivative, d upper mu, applied to the covariant derivative, lower mu, of alpha of x. So let's look at this term. These terms, first, this is d mu alpha is written here, it's d mu alpha. So this term is d mu alpha of x, the ordinary Laplacian applied on x, minus a term which comes from the fact that the gauge transformation are non-commutative. So it's minus I d mu of a mu of x alpha of x. So d mu will act both on a mu and on alpha. And so this is, let's write it here. First, it can act on d mu, or it can act on alpha. So this is d mu alpha of x minus I, a mu of x commutator with d mu alpha of x minus I d mu a mu of x alpha of x. This is a variation of alpha. So you see now that this is a differential operator acting on alpha. This is a differential operator alpha of x. Remember, alpha is a 2x2 matrix. And if you want to write it as so this differential operator, it has a term which contains the two derivatives. It's a standard Laplacian. Then it has a term which contains one derivative of A, and it has a term which is multiplication of some function by alpha. Okay? So, and if you want to write it in terms of the, so this is this operator. So this is just the way of d mu of alpha of x. So this is a differential operator, which depends on A. A mu. Because of this not commutator. Okay? And this No, you know, this is a gauge fixing condition. So you can consider this differential operator. You can write it just as the functional derivative. So you can write it as the functional derivative of df of a under a gauge transformation. So you can write it as a matrix element of alpha y, acting on alpha y. So this is a differential operator. Okay. And if you like to, so it's a functional derivative with respect to gauge transformation, an infinitesimal gauge transformation of the gauge fixing condition. And this is a bit abstract, so let us write it in terms of components for SU2. For SU2, the functional, the FABC are just epsilon ABC. This is a structure constant of the which involves in the commutator. And therefore, this writes this this d mu a mu d mu of alpha acting of is just acting on some alpha a of x is just the ordinary Laplacian acting on alpha a of x. Remember, this is a matrix minus epsilon. No, this is not a Now this is just a field. It's a component of alpha. Alpha is a two matrix, so it's epsilon a b c a mu of x of c d mu of alpha b of x. So you have a d mu which acts, okay, minus epsilon a b c d mu a mu c of x times delta alpha b of x. I'm sorry, alpha b of x. So this is the explicit expression for this differential operator. So this differential operator means reads delta times, you see you have a delta, here I have b and b, so this is delta a b minus epsilon a b c a mu c d mu minus epsilon a b c d mu a mu c acting on alpha b of x. So this is this differential operator. Okay. So this is the differential operator, this one. And let me call it J. Let me. J. That's the way my notes. I have a differential operator acting on function on the Lie algebra of the group. So it's a differential operator. Which sends a space into the Lie algebra of SU2. Okay, so this is a bit abstract, but basically these differential operators tell you what is the variation of the gauge fixing condition when you make a gauge transformation on the gauge fixing condition? Okay. And this J can be written as a functional derivative of the gauge fixing condition, which involves derivatives, when I make a gauge transformation on A. So I have gauge fixing condition depending on A, and I take a functional derivative with respect to a gauge variation. So it's like the functional derivative of the Lagrangian density in ordinary, you know, classical mechanics, except instead of considering the Lagrangian function, I consider the gauge fixing function. And that's the same kind of functional derivative. And in the same way that the functional derivative of the Laplacian is of the Lagrangian density is an operator acting on functions, it's minus Laplacian for a free field. Here, it's another operator. You see? Okay. So now the solution of the problem is, oh, I should stop. I've explained that, it's a bit long, but that this Padeyev Popov determinant that I just this Fadeyev Popov determinant, the Fadeyev Popov determinant is just the functional determinant. So it's an operator, so it can be considered as a matrix. So it's a determinant, a functional determinant of a differential operator of J, namely the functional determinant of the functional derivative of a gauge fixing of the function of the generating gauge function condition when I make a variation of the differential operator when I make a gauge, an infinitesimal gauge transformation. So in this notation is very compact but very abstract. But on this example, that is the one that I worked out, you see what is this differential operator? J is this differential operator. It contains two derivative terms, a one derivative term depending on the gauge field, and a zero derivative terms depending on the derivative of the gauge field. So this determinant is a functional of A. G is a functional of A itself. So here I have another terms which depend on A, which must be taken into account. So now let's make the break, 5 minutes, and I explain briefly later on where does this comes from. Okay. Yes?
Can we see JS coming from some like a residual gauge invariant that like somehow the gauge fixing condition also?
Yes.
Can be?
Yes. I'll see. It will be clear from the next part of the lecture. So wait a bit, and you'll understand how is this one. It's not residual gauge invariance, but okay. I need to drink something. So I need to find a glass. So this was two.
Swimming that. Yes.
This was three.
Pick a slice. I break.
This is four.
Too bad you made that. a big representative of everyone. Thanks.
Yes.
Why don't we just pick one slice? Why do we pick like an entire surface of slices or something?
No, no, I take one slice, but I want to have a calculation whose results is independent of the choice of slice. That's the point.
What?
I want to have a result for my functional integral which is independent of the choice of slice.
I'm just moving.
That's the point. This must be independent. Of the choice of slice, of a gauge fixing. Here I took
gauge fixing times Fadeo Popov will be like gauge invariant.
Yes.
That's what you're saying.
Yes.
So you do the same functional integrals methods for like ordinary action, right?
Ordinary.
So now, so we have action, right? SA.
Yes.
And we want to do same functional integral methods, but we had to introduce this gauge fixing condition.
Yes.
So we have Fadeo Popov. So together they will be gauge invariant. So you can kind of leave them alone and like do the functional integral methods only for action, right?
Yeah. No. We start from a functional integral which is done with, just with the action, but we want a result. We want to reformulate this as a functional integral where there is a gauge fixing in order to be able to do perturbative calculation. Otherwise, we are stuck. There is no propagator.
Aren't you kind of already picking a slice by fixing, by like having that delta?
Yes. If I introduce this delta, I pick a slice because I consider only in the space of all field configuration, the states which satisfy the gauge fixing condition. So I pick a slice. But if I had chosen another gauge fixing condition, for instance, the axial gauge or the Coulomb gauge, or some more fancy gauge, I would have chosen another slice.
Oh, okay.
But I want to be sure that the result is independent of the slice. Otherwise, I've explicitly broken in my calculation gauge invariance. And if my calculation breaks gauge invariance, I get in trouble immediately with unitarity, you know, the longitudinal modes for the gauge bosons do not get out. So already for Maxwell's theory, I would be in trouble.
Okay.
You see. Okay, so where does this come from? Now, I will explain briefly where this comes from. Well, this is going to be a calculation a bit formal because in order to be sure, to be quick, I will use those very compact notation without any indices. But, okay. Where does this come from? It just comes from the idea of introducing one in the functional integral. You see? So, let's just consider that I have the gauge fixing condition f of a equals 0. This is my gauge fixing condition. F of A means d mu, a mu of A is 0 for all point of space and A. That's okay. So I have a gauge fixing condition. So I know that if I start from a given A, now starts from some arbitrary A. If I have chosen my gauge fixing condition right, I know there is a gauge transformation G. See? Which depend on A. So let us call it equal GF of A, such that the gauge transform of A satisfies the gauge condition, such that A, on which I act GF by here, this gauge transformation, you see, AGF. F is for gauge fixing, satisfies F of AGF equals zero. You see, this means that if I start from a general A somewhere here, I know that I will find a gauge transformation which brings me back to the gauge fixing slice. If it has not that this property, then I'm in trouble. I've not chosen a good gauge fixing condition. Okay, so to each A, I can associate a gauge transformation G of A such that F of AG, the gauge fixed condition, satisfies the gauge fixing condition. You see? It's a bit abstract, but so to each A, I associate a GF. So associate a GF of A. A. F means gauge fixing. Of course, this GF of A depends on the choice of gauge fixing. Because, for instance, if I have chosen, I start from this one. If I choose this gauge slice, I have to go there. If I choose this gauge fixing condition, I have to go there. So these are performed by two different gauge transformations. So of course, this GF depends on the gauge fixing condition. Okay, so now let's write something trivial. Let's write in my gauge integration. Let's write that for each A, I write 1, the number 1, equal the integral over the gauge group of dG, some gauge transformation, times the Dirac delta function of GF of A. Okay? You see, for each A, there is a GF of A, and I just integrate over all the gauge group. But pick just in this integral the G which is equal to GF of A. So this is a Dirac delta functions on the group, the big group of all gauge transformation, and this is an integral over the group. Well, if you are a bit worried about that, remember that for compact Lie group, there is a well-defined notion of measure, which is called the R measure, and therefore a well-defined concept of Dirac delta function on the group. Okay. So, let us do just the following trick. I write my functional integral as I write my initial functional integral z of integral of the whole gauge field configuration of d of a, well, I've got exponential minus s of a. By for each a, I introduce the one, this one. So I integrate over g. I integrate over the gauge group d of g. So I integrate over all the gauge transformation. And then I introduce the delta function on the gauge group of g minus gf of a. Okay. I've not changed anything. Okay. But now gf of a is determined by, is given by the gauge condition that f of a g equals zero. That's the gauge fixing condition, which can be formally written as delta of f of ag equals zero. The condition that some function of some variable is zero can be written as a delta function of the value of the function by a constraint like that, not equal zero. It may be introduced by the constraint like that. You see, a delta function, which is a delta function I've introduced here. Okay. But now think about ordinary one-dimensional integral. Imagine that I have a function of a real variable x, and I have some function f of x, some function f of x, this is f, which has only one zero. One zero, x zero, such that f of x zero equals zero. Well, then you know that you can rewrite the ordinary Dirac delta function delta of x minus x zero as a delta function over f of x, because when f of x is equal to zero, x equal x to zero. But there is a change, there is a Jacobian in the change, because you are changing a variable from x to f. So this is has to be multiplied by the df over dx. Well, this is a capital X. Well, with a absolute value. So the Dirac delta function at x0 is equal to a Dirac delta function on the function of the x times the absolute derivative of the derivative of x, but of course at x equal x0, because otherwise this is non-zero, so we don't care. So basically you have to take into account the slope. This is the slope of the function f, because you are changing from this variable to this variable, so you have a Jacobian. The Jacobian is just the slope of the function. Well, this is true for function of one variable. This is true for function of n variables, but here the absolute value of the derivative has to be replaced by the absolute value of the determinant of the Jacobian, dFi over dxj, if you want to enforce the condition that some fi of xj equals 0 from e equal 1 to n, and you have n variables, and therefore it can be extended to functional integral, you see. So I can rewrite delta of g minus gf as, so this delta function equals the Dirac delta function for the gauge fixing condition times the absolute value of the determinant of the derivative of the gauge fixing with respect to g. I integrate over g here. So delta of f of a g divided by delta of g. Well, with a correct measure on the gauge group. And that's the absolute value. So now this is a functional determinant, because we have seen on the example of the Lorentz gauge that the Jacobian of the transformation from F to G is a differential operator which has been written here. It's this operator. Okay. So up to now, this is what. Now, use gauge invariants. And change the variables. For each A, we can move from variable A to A GF of A. And you can check that you can replace equal a prime. And this delta of f of ag becomes delta of f of a prime. This becomes, this is not. Use gauge invariance by changing the integration of a g. Goes from the integration of a g into g prime equal g gf of a minus 1 somehow. Go back. In the gauge. And changed a accordingly. And this means that by forming this change of variables, this is equivalent to, for A, changing AG in the AG here into A. I use gauge invariant. So this last step is valid because the action is gauge invariant and because the measure is gauge invariant. And using gauge invariance, I can replace integration over the condition over AG by integrating over A, and I get integration over DG of the gauge group the integration over G get out of this, because I have a delta function over f of a instead of f of a, which depend on g. So I get integration over g times integration over dA, the space of all field configuration. Well, the action is not changed. And I have my gauge fixing condition, delta f of a, times my absolute value of the functional determinant of this Fadiev Popov operator, which can be written now as delta f of a divided by delta g, which is the Fadiev Popov determinant. So with this trick, you see that the big function, the original functional integral, by this trick on introducing one and repressing it in terms of the gauge fixing condition, factors out the volume of the gauge group. This is the volume of the gauge group, which, as it should factor out, because at the beginning we are integrating over the whole space of gauge configuration. So the volume times the gauge fixed, functional integral. So basically, well, the Fadiev Popov determinant comes from the trick to introduce one as an integral over all gauge transformation, so that we are sure we get close to the gauge slice for any A, and from the fact that when writing this gauge fixing condition, this integral over the gauge group as an integral, as a measure over the A with a delta function on the gauge fixing condition, there has to be a Jacobian, which is this Fadiev Popov determinant. So that's where it comes from. And it takes care of this bit subtle question of which measure must be associated to different gauge slice. Okay, and you can check that, well, in fact, it follows from this formula, since basically we'd write a delta function, that if you change the gauge fixing condition, then the functional integral is the same. So in fact, this doesn't depend on f. Well, f has to be a condition which selects one point in each orbit. Okay. Well, 5 minutes left. So, let me do two remarks. First, in the case of the gauge, SU2, well, where is FU? Oh, no, it's here. You know, it's my blackboard 4. This is blackboard 5. On my blackboard 4, I have the explicit expression for the operator, the Fadiev Popov operator, which whose determinant gives the Fadiev Popov determinant. For SU2, it contains an ordinary Laplacian and two terms which depend on A, with the derivative acting on alpha on the function, and one d mu A, which is a function, which contains epsilon ABC. Epsilon ABC are here just the structure constant of the algebra. So in fact, this formula is valid for any gauge group. You replace the epsilon ABC by the structure constant of the algebra. Okay, so what about Maxwell? For Maxwell's theory, it's based on the U1 group. There is only one generator, so no A. Okay, but most importantly, Maxwell, the U1 gauge group, is abelian. So the structure constant are zero. No epsilon ABC, because the structure constant of the gauge of are zero. If there is only one structure constant, it has to be totally anti-symmetric. It depends only on one index, so it's zero. Because Maxwell's U1 group is abelian. So if you quantize in the functional integral Maxwell's theory using this gauge fixing procedure and this trick, there is a Fadeyev-Popov determinant. Yeah? But then d mu is just the scalar Laplacian. It's independent of A. So it's the same. The Fadeyev-Popov determinant is just the determinant of A. So it's a of Laplacian. So it's a constant, which factors out. And that's why quantization of Maxwell's theory is easy. Naively fixing the gauge by, for instance, the Lorentz gauge makes things, is that enough? You factor out some of the degrees of freedom, and that's fine. You continue the calculation with the transverse mode and not the longitudinal one. That's what Gang has been doing. Okay, so things are easy. But in fact, there is a gauge fixing term too. Okay, there is a Fadeyev-Popov determinant, and this might be important. Second, and that's what I'm going to discuss during the next lecture, we have a determinant of some differential operator. Well, we have the absolute value of a determinant of some here, for instance, d mu. It's a functional determinant, but we have. Now, assume that this determinant is never zero. And doesn't, so that it doesn't change sign. Well, in fact, this is a delicate point, but we can forget about this point. We are doing perturbation theory, because if the Fadeyev-Popov determinant change in my picture where I had a gauge slice f equals zero, f of a equals zero, and I have my gauge orbits. This is a Jacobian, and if it vanishes, it means that somehow something like bad like that occurs. It means that the gauge slice become tangent to the orbit, and therefore, generically, it goes back. So we have several inequivalent configuration. They are different. They are equivalent by gauge transformation, but they all satisfy the gauge fixing condition. So if not, we have this problem where we have different conjugation of the gauge field, which are equivalent because they are on the gauge orbit, but which are different. These are called Gribov copies. Okay, but assume that the determinant never vanishes. That's okay in perturbation theory. Because in perturbation theory, what you are doing is are studying the neighborhood of A equals zero in the functional integral, and one can show that Gribov copy doesn't occur in the neighborhood of A. Okay, then we can replace the absolute value of the determinant by the determinant itself. And well, in order to be, if we want it to be definite positive, this is a definite positive operator, that's minus the Laplacian, so this is the determinant which is positive. Okay, and then we have seen a fermionic pass integral. Integrals that integration of Gaussians gives determinant. So we can write the determinant of this differential operator as a fermionic pass integral over two fermionic fields C and C bar, or C bar and C, of exponential minus C bar, this differential operator, minus d mu, d mu, C. Well, these are, well, this is a differential operator acting on fields. So these are fields which are fermionic. Grassmann. And if you take into account all the degrees, the gauge degrees of freedom, in fact, they belong to the, this is an operator acting on generator of the gauge transformation. So this is an operator acting on elements in the G algebra. So in fact, the C's and C bars depend on X and depends on group of the group indices. A equals 1, 2, 3. So the C and C bar are Grassmannian field that belongs to the Lie algebra of the SU2, of the gauge group. So they transform like the, belongs to the adjoint representation. Okay. So this is a, and remember, d mu depends on A. And therefore, you have fields which carry charges. D mu, capital D mu is written here and is, well, it's hidden now, contains Laplacian. So those are fields that propagates and that propagates like bosons, but which are coupled to the AMU. You see, so they are bosonic field, spin equals zero, and they are fermions. So they are, they violate something, they violate unitarity. It's violated. Okay, so they do not behave as physical fields, they are unphysical. So that's the reason why they are called Fadiev Popov ghosts. ghost field. Well, actually, C is a ghost, and C, its conjugate, C bar, is the anti-ghost. Okay, so you have not only ghost, but anti-ghost, like you have electrons and anti-electrons or positons. Okay? And so that's very strange. But those, this determinant is there to cancel, to take care of the gauge fixing condition. And we know that if we don't take this into account, in Maxwell's theory, you have longitudinal modes, which are not coupled to the physical modes, but which do not satisfy unitarity either. And well, the purpose of this ghost field is to compensate, cancel out from the source of unitarity generated by the longitudinal modes in order to that the physical modes stay safe. So they are very important. So you can treat only consistently the longitudinal modes of a gauge theory if you incorporate the ghosts. And they are coupled because of these terms. So that's what I'm going to explain next time. Okay, thank you.